Hey there, here's a great way to listen to Alt Latino before summer ends. NPR One. It's an app for your phone, kind of like Pandora for public radio. It's full of news and podcasts, including Alt Latino. Whenever you're ready to listen, NPR One has something great just for you. Find it on your app store, NPRONE, NPR One. Check it out.
Claro. Quiero dedicar esta canción con mucho amor y respeto. Más que una canción, es una oración de amor que quiero dedicar, como siempre, con el mismo amor, cariño y respeto, a todas las mamás que esta noche me han venido a visitar. Sobre todo para aquellas que están un poquito más lejos de mí.
From NPR Music, this is Alt Latino. I'm Felix Contreras. We let that music play a little bit longer than we normally do. Jasmine Garz is away this week, and it was a big week in the Latin music world, but not in a good way. We lost a musician whose art transcended generations, borders, and even classifications. Juan Gabriel died earlier this week at his home in Southern California. The initial reports indicate he suffered a fatal heart attack, and he was just 66 years old. So today, we're going to take a look back at his remarkable career. And to do that, we've invited some special guests to help us look back at his legacy. First, we have Carolina Miranda. She's a staff writer from the Los Angeles Times. Carolina, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
And we also have Josh Kuhn, who's a professor at the USC Annenberg School in Southern California. Josh, welcome back.
Thank you. Thank you.
They are joining us from NPR member station KPCC in Pasadena. And we're also working a special collaboration with NPR's Code Switch. So we have reporter Adrian Florido here joining me in the studio here in Washington, D.C. Adrian, welcome to Alt Latino.
It's good to be here, Felix.
Okay, before we get into discussions and conversations, let's hear the rest of this classic song and classic performance of Amor Eterno from the Palacio de Bellas Artes. Amor Eterno.
Estar contigo para seguir amándolo. Yo he sufrido mucho por tu ausencia. Desde ese día hasta hoy no soy feliz. Y aunque tengo y muy tranquila mi conciencia, yo sé que pude y sé que pude haber yo hecho más por ti. Oscura soledad estoy viviendo yo, y la misma soledad de tu sepulcro, mamá. Amor eterno.
peor de tantas despedidas y de esperas. Soledad, eso es todo lo que tengo ahora y tus recuerdos que hacen más triste la angustia de vivir pensando como siempre en ti. Ojos que te vieron tanto y que no han vuelto a verte hasta el sol de hoy. Tristes de tanto extrañarte y de tanto esperarte desde aquel adiós. Soledad, esto es todo lo que tengo ahora y esto es todo lo que tengo ahora y tus recuerdos que hacen más triste la angustia de vivir pensando como siempre y para siempre y por siempre en ti.
Okay, I may be wrong, but I think that's everyone's favorite version of that song. Let's take a look back, guys. Thank you all for joining me. Let's take a look back at his legacy. But first, let's talk about the reaction that happened in this age of social media. It was incredibly impressive and overwhelming.
It was one of those things that I think with any big death, you see kind of what I call the internet pylon. Everybody is kind of jumping on to share videos and share memories. But what was interesting to me is that his death happened shortly before the MTV Video Music Awards, and I think it was killing the VMAs on Twitter. It was just such an outpouring. You were immediately seeing posts online. You were immediately seeing these tributes, people quoting his lyrics. So it was this pretty, it was almost this eruption of grief that happened over his death.
Though, of course, all of the music on the VMAs just, you know, it's a much higher quality than Juan Gabriel's. That was a rough collision of tastes there. You know, I was thinking a lot as I was watching people react, and people indeed in that pylon of writing furiously about that kind of old idea that what music is not the sounds that comes out of a trumpet or a piano. It's not actually what we think of as music. What music really is feeling. Music is something that is actually born inside of us when we hear music. That's the true music, is what music awakens inside of us. And I think that's what you saw more than anything, or at least that's what I saw more than anything, was less the kind of social impact of him, let's say. That came a day later. But the immediate responses were all about what he meant to people and how his music he wasn't just liked by people or loved by people. His music actually defined who people were. It defined and shaped how people thought of themselves as individuals. And it was just a clear testament, I think, to his power of someone who, to call him an entertainer, to call him a songwriter, to call him a singer, it doesn't even come close to the impact that he had.
And you know, Felix, one of the things that obviously happens when a big star like Juan Gabriel dies is that people play music, the artist's music, to remember this artist by, right? And the thing about Juan Gabriel's music is that his music was the music that Mexicans and Latin Americans across the world played when they needed a cathartic release, when they wanted to kind of express emotion, right? And so they were mourning his death, playing his music to remember him, but his songs were the songs that we played when we needed that kind of emotional release, almost seemed to kind of magnify the sort of emotional expression, right, and made it feel that much more painful.
Were there any tributes or even just casual tweets or Facebook posts that left an impression on you guys?
Yeah, and I think what was also interesting was watching, particularly in the English language world, and I was very much a part of this debate and conversation, was how do you talk about Juan Gabriel? And people like myself were trying to, for those who might not understand the depth of his impact, were trying to find ways to convey his impact to English speakers. And it was interesting to watch both how people were comparing him and who he was being compared to. Mm-hmm. Elton John, Prince, Cole Porter. And then the debates that would immediately follow, that people would be so upset that anyone even dared to compare him to anyone.
Right.
And there's something of, you know, that's funny about that, but also really, really important about that kind of colonialist gesture, I think, of like that he only matters because we can put him in a register of an Anglo pop star, let's say. And so it was just fascinating to watch how within 2 hours of his passing, these big debates came up around whose culture matters, who gets to tell the stories, and from what point of view are we narrating the world?
Which in the age of social media is a healthy conversation to have, which may not have happened, let's say, if this happened 20 years ago. Or even let's go back to when Selena passed away, right? That was a similar situation where it was an opening to a part of the culture that many people in the mainstream culture we're not even aware of. I've had at least 3 people come up to me and say, you know, I had no idea who he was or that he even existed, but now that I see that he's such a big deal, you know, I went to YouTube and started listening to his stuff, and you know, it's opened a world for me. And I think that was more difficult to do, obviously, back then, but having that conversation now where even the back and forth about who gets to tell the story and which culture is it reflected through is a significant step.
And to me, it was interesting how this event, you know, did happen in parallel with the VMAs, where his death went entirely unacknowledged, and yeah, to some degree still speaks to the invisibility that a lot of Latino culture has in, you know, the American mainstream, that this is something that would not be acknowledged on a pop music stage in the United States, is also telling about where we're at or not at culturally.
Yeah, sure. And I think that's also crucial when it's important to remember for all of the way that he's talked about almost as an underground or grassroots figure in some ways. Of course, he wasn't that at all. I mean, he was as mega star, mega commercial, million selling, incredibly prolific, over 1,800 songs that he wrote, not just for himself, but for dozens of other artists. He was a hit maker. He was a confirmed icon of the people, but also a confirmed icon of the industry. And he navigated that divide throughout his career. And I think it really does speak to that gap that continues, that, you know, this was not a marginal artist who needed to get props on the VMAs. This was like as big as you get. But I'm actually secretly kind of happy he didn't even get mentioned on the VMAs. I just wanted to, because I think that's in a way, it's a dying enterprise. And I think that what Juan Gabriel represents and the industry that he represents and the communities that his music speaks with and alongside of are in the process of continuing to create these new worlds and new platforms for expression.
Okay. In the process of doing this show, I asked you guys to send in couple of suggestions, some of your favorite songs, some of the music that you thought we should hear on the show. So we're going to go right to one of those picks. Carolina, ladies first, what do you want to hear?
Hasta que te conocí. That's my Juan Gabriel jam.
No sabía de tristezas, ni de lágrimas, ni nada que me hicieran llorar. Yo sabía de cariño, de ternura, porque a mí desde pequeño eso me enseñó mamá. Eso me enseñó mamá. Eso y muchas cosas más. Yo jamás sufrí.
Yo jamás. You know, this is how I came to Juan Gabriel. It was to this song. In the early 90s, I was living in South America, and this was my... this was the song I would cry sing during a bad breakup. And part of it is because I think his lyrics and the lyrics to this song in particular capture the sense of wounded bewilderment of the spurned lover, that you are at this, on the one hand, you know, outraged and vengeful towards the person that has done you wrong, but at the same time you adore them and you can't live without them and you think about them more every day, you know. And so it's like he's capturing that ambivalence that I think we all go through when we go through a bumpy romantic breakup or any kind of romantic trouble. It's that sense of like, I love you, I hate you, I'll die without you, I'm gonna kill you, you know. Yeah. It's like, you ruined my life, please come back, you
know? And the way he structures it as a song, right? I mean, it's like the first three quarters of that song is this lead up. Yeah. He's just like, yes, he's climbing us up this mountain that I, you know, my mother taught me how to live happily, and I was happy and I was so happy and everything's good, and I don't like being unhappy, I'm a happy person. And then I met you.
And then I met you.
Right? And it's like this knife. Right? And then the last line, though, right? He just comes back at the end and it's just like, and that's why I don't love you. Exactly. I mean, this was a powerful, the way he structured that song was actually not a very classic pop structure where he kind of tells you right away what the song is about. It's beautifully kind of led in, and then exactly, in a more almost melodrama style. Just kind of stabs you right when he wants to, and then he gets the final blow at the end.
Exactly. There's all of this foreshadowing because it's all in the past tense, in that very sort of soft, whispery lead up. Everything's in the past tense. I was very happy. I knew how to love. I'd been taught all of these wonderful things by my mother. It's all in the past tense. So you know that something is coming, and that something is you.
Pero te encontré. Carolina mentioned how she came to Juan Gabriel's music. Adrian, what about you? Where did you dip your toes into this?
I think, as for many Mexican kids, Juan Gabriel's music was the soundtrack of Sunday morning cleaning. So I think that was probably the very first exposure I had to him, was my alarm clock on Sunday mornings, because my mom would get up before we did, obviously, start cleaning and blast the Juan Gabriel, along with the Serenanda Vicente Fernandez, but the Juan Gabriel, and that would say, okay, it's time to get up, right? Later, I think I might have been in the fifth or sixth grade when I started watching this novela with my mom called Te Sigo Amando, and his song, Te Sigo Amando, was the introduction to that novela. And so every time I listen, I hear that song to this day, I think back to those weeknights sitting in front of the TV with my mom watching this excellent novela. And then beyond that, you know, eventually I went to a concert of his at the Universal Amphitheater, which he sold out three times a year for many years.
Sure.
With my parents.
This is in Southern California.
This is, it's now demolished, but it was there in Universal City near Universal Studios. And, you know, I have this vibrant, explicit memory of when he started singing El Noa Noa, which often was one of the most kind of spectacular sort of visual performances at his concerts. And he took the cord of the microphone during the song and he started jump roping with it. And I think that was kind of what cemented in my mind that Juan Gabriel was one of the greatest Latin American performers of this generation, if not the best.
Okay, you snuck in a request there for the next song, so we're going to go ahead and do it. This is one of the songs that you brought in, El Noa Noa, and this is the studio version?
This is the version that played in the movie by the same name.
I mean, it's a straight up country.
Yeah, it's like he could be Dwight Yoakam here.
That's a body morph I want to see.
Thank you. Gabriel, Noah Noah from Juan Gabriel. That was, now what's the story behind that? This is the club where he got started, is that the deal?
That's what is said, that was the club where he got started in Ciudad Juarez. And so it was essentially a tribute song to the place that kind of gave a start to his career. It's a happy song about a club, a bar, where you can go and dance and have fun all night and not sort of worry about anything else. Despite the fact that the lyrics are purely happy, I still get like a sort of melancholy kind of feel from the song, right? Like there's sort of a nostalgia there. The lyrics are really interesting. At one point he says, "Este es un lugar de ambiente donde todo es diferente." This is like a different kind of place, you know. And I don't know what his idea, you know, sort of was behind sort of that line, but to me I think it suggests that this is a place where he felt comfortable, kind of in a world where Juan Gabriel often was sort of struggling to just sort of be himself. El Noa Noa was a place where he could just go and be himself. And if you watch the music video accompanying that song, he's just letting loose, completely dancing with a big crowd of people in the bar. And it's just, you can tell that there's not like a worry in his mind, you know?
Sure.
Yeah, he wants to dance without end. You know, and ambiente, of course, has also, you know, long been code word for queerness or,
that's right,
you know, gayness. And so this idea of like the kind of utopia of the dance floor that was by 1980 was already a staple of disco culture around the world, that there was a heaven, there was a paradise that the dance floor could deliver, where difference was accepted and celebrated and set free.
Yeah, it's like the dance floor is a place of safety.
Yeah.
And yeah, that's what the song is about. But then also a sense, but lyrics that also resonate universally, because I think to, you know, anybody who has to deal with life, and especially in a place like Mexico, it's like the escape of a club where you are treated well and you can dance is a welcome escape.
Yeah.
There's a lot to talk about, and we're going to return to that theme. But first, Josh, while we're going down the line, how did you come to Juan Gabriel's music?
Well, I, as someone who grew up as a non-Mexican, which isn't now the new way I've decided I'm going to define my identity. not as a white kid in LA, just non-Mexican.
We're so sorry.
I know, it's exactly. I came to him very late. I mean, I came to his music when I was listening to Rock en Español, and I really had no idea who he was until my favorite rock bands in Mexico City were covering his songs. When Maldita Vecindad did a cover of Juan Gabriel on their record El Circo, were performing it, they did a live version that they put on the record. It made me investigate who he was, and it was, you know, how is it possible that this rock band who were, you know, doing all these incredible stylistic mergers, but were also so urban and, you know, inspiring mosh pits across Mexico City and had this kind of outlaw stance, you know, who is this Juan Gabriel? And I started listening to his music because of Maldita, and I think for a lot of people who grew up as Rock en Español fans, particularly here in Southern California, that Juan Gabriel could actually be someone that you got to through rock and punk acts. And then later, Julieta Venegas, of course, covered his song in 1990, one of his songs in 1990. And that, I think, just kept cementing for me the important role that he played. And so I just want to mention that because I think it speaks to just how many artists of all different genres, but also of different kind of subcultural classifications. Like, there was something so normative and mainstream about him in many ways, and then there was something completely underground, punk rock. He was loved by, you know, aunts and grandmothers as much as he was by kids in mosh pits. And it's just, it's kind of extraordinary. There really isn't an artist that compares in that way.
I want to go back to something that you said, Carolina, when you heard his music and you were in South America.
I mean, I was in school, and my background is South American. I'm Chilean and Peruvian.
So
I was studying in college.
So I'm curious to know what was the impression, because he had such almost a worldwide command of the you know, the Spanish speaking record buying public. What was the impression? What was the his reputation? What was his position there in South America?
Well, it's an important one. I think part of the interesting thing about you know, the power of Mexican media and the power of Mexican culture is that to some degree, because of that power, it ends up becoming the default culture of Latin America, the rest of Latin, Spanish-speaking Latin America, in a way. You know, I have a Chilean uncle who gets drunk and sings El Rey at parties. He's not singing Chilean cuecas, he's singing El Rey. And Juan Gabriel was part of that presence. And, you know, he used to play regularly at the Festival de Viña del Mar, the big music to-do that they have there every year. He's toured through Chile, he's toured through Peru, he's toured through the rest of South America. And this was someone who you heard on the airwaves, you know, at the same time, you know, you might be hearing some American metal act or a Chilean band. Like, he was part of the soundscape of everyday life in a Chilean city in the 1990s. And, you know, before that and certainly after that, I mean, he was just part of the culture. And it's interesting because it's like, for example, Chileans in particular are not a very flamboyant culture. They're one of the more like starchier South American countries. I say this with a lot of love.
Of course.
Mi gente.
Mi gente starchy.
Mi gente cartucha. You know, and here comes this singer with these very emotional lyrics and these very flamboyant performances. And if you look up videos of his performances in Viña del Mar, that crowd is going bananas and they're singing along. They know the lyrics. He stops singing and they're singing right there with him. So, you know, when we say that he's universal, I think that is no exaggeration.
Let's come back to Josh. Everybody else had a pick so far. What do you want to hear right now?
Oh, I would say La Frontera. Let's listen to that.
A mí me gusta más estar en la frontera porque la gente es más sencilla y más sincera. Me gusta cómo se divierte, cómo lleva la vida alegre, positiva y sin problema. Aquí es todo diferente, todo, todo es diferente. La frontera, la frontera, la frontera. A mí me gusta más estar en la frontera porque la gente es más feliz y siempre espera. Vivir mejor, estar mejor y se supera. Y todo logra porque aquí la gente espera. Aquí es todo diferente, todo, todo es diferente. La frontera, la frontera, la frontera.
Josh, talk to me about why the frontera, the border, is so important and so significant in the Juan Gabriel story.
Well, I mean, he grows up in Juarez and really is shaped as a musician at the border, not in the center of Mexico. And there's this long tradition within Mexican culture of a kind of centralismo of where the best of Mexican culture allegedly comes from the center. And to have him so proudly declare his allegiance to the border, that he likes being at the border where everything is different. And again, that difference can lead us into all kinds of different conversations. But at least in the taking him literally there, that something is different at the border. And there was a way that even though Juan Gabriel quickly emerged as a national artist, as someone who represented in many ways Mexico as a people, as a culture, as a nation, the idea that might actually begin at the border and not in the center was a pretty radical idea, and still in some ways is a radical idea. But it also speaks to him as a border artist, and I think that's another way to frame him, is that he's as much a Mexican artist as a border or borderlands artist whose impact is so strong precisely because he speaks to both sides of the border. That he you know, was as much the soundtrack to Mexican life in the United States as he was Mexican life in Mexico.
That was Jerry Lee Lewis on the piano there on that track. Before we wrap up the show today, I want to get to this segment that I labeled, Was He Gay or Not and Does It Matter? Let's talk a little bit about that and you know, where that fits into the Juan Gabriel legacy.
I think it matters, just like so many other aspects of his life and work mattered. I think, you know, it certainly informed his work. It informed who he was in private and on stage. I mean, it was defining. in such a purely Latin American style. It was this issue that was his sexuality was acknowledged without being acknowledged. You know, it's like we all know what's going on here, but we're just not going to acknowledge. Right. It will not be discussed in public. And there was a famous interview that he gave about almost 15 years ago, where somebody asked him about it, and he told the interviewer, you know, you shouldn't always. Things you see, you shouldn't always ask about.
Right.
So he was always very, very coy about it. But, you know, I think everyone knew that he was likely gay. I mean, right. I think at this point we can safely
the
assume
open
that
secret.
He was. Yeah, it was the open secret. And it was this strangely Latin American way of dealing with it of like, I'm going to be gay. I'm going to be flamboyant. I will wear capes. I will wear bedazzled outfits. I will be androgynous in so many ways. But we're just not going to label it.
Right. But, it's the Walter Mercado effect.
Yeah, yeah. We're not going to label it because to label it then would make it real. But by not making it real, it becomes an act. It becomes a persona. And perhaps that offers safety.
One other way to answer it is that, you know, does it matter? It doesn't on all kinds of different levels, because we're talking about categories on the one hand that actually mean nothing, and he transcended all of them. And on the other hand, it those categories really do matter. And why it matters is it's more about so many of the young men and women who found solace and found a mirror in him. You know, he gave people freedom to be who they were, to imagine themselves, to be the way they want to be, arguably kept young kids alive because there was someone who moved like him, who sounded like him, who suggested the possibilities of living differently, as he, as he often sang. And so many of the remembrances in the past few days have been coming out about just that, of queer artists and musicians who said, you know, without him, I'm not sure what my path would have been, that he was crucial to the way that I came to understand my own sexuality. And so it's really important, and especially in you know, within Mexico and within Mexican culture across borders, that he could do that for so many young people is so important.
Quite a long-lasting and significant legacy to consider. Guys, thank you so much for joining me this week.
Awesome to be here.
Thank you.
Thank you for
viva
having
Juan
us.
Gabriel.
Viva Juan Gabriel.
Viva Juan Gabriel.
We have Carolina Miranda, who is a writer for the LA Times, or the Los Angeles Times, excuse me. We also have Josh Kuhn, who is a professor at the USC Annenberg School in Southern California. And they're joining me from KPCC in Southern California, Pasadena. And with me in the studio, Adrian Florido from NPR's Code Switch team. Again, thank you all for joining me this week. Okay, now let's have a lucha libre. Which song are we going to go out on to finish the show? Which should we do? You each brought some songs in. Which is the one that's going to close the show?
La Farsante.
That sure. That could be good.
Let's do that.
Sure.
That was easy.
Done.
Yo creí que eras buena. Yo creí que eras sincera. Yo te di mi cariño. Resultaste traicionera.
I want to remind you that you can hear all the songs that we played today on our website. We're going to have the videos, all the videos that we talked about. You can watch and compare notes with us. That's at npr.org/altlatino. Also, we want to hear from you about Juan Gabriel. You can reach us on Facebook and Twitter. We are NPR's Alt Latino. Jasmine Guards will be back soon. Until then, I'm Felix Contreras. This has been Alt Latino.
Verás, traicionera, lo vas a pagar muy.
bueno a la buena y por la mala soy muy malo. No quisiste ser buena y ya ves lo que resulta. Yo no quise ser malo, pero tú tienes la culpa.